So I'm a first-time founder as a 46-year-old. I mean, 43 when we founded it, with three kids, two in middle school, one kindergartner. I'm not a 25-year-old tech whiz who can work all through the night and like get something done by tomorrow for sure. Because like, you know, my daughter turned 11 today and we had to give her her pet lizard before 8 o'clock this morning. And like having kids takes time. So I think parent founders, it's becoming more of a big category because people are founding companies at older ages.
Michael Chabon has a great book, Manhood for Amateurs, all about fatherhood. And it opens up with an essay he wrote for Details Magazine about how he just brought his kids into a grocery store and bought some groceries. And the cashier was like, "You must be a great dad because you took a kid to the store." You know, nobody dies totally. and you're a genius. And, you know, men are held to too low a standard and women are held to too high.
The other example I've heard before that I always love and I kind of roll my eyes and like smile a little bit because it is what it is, but it needs to change is the walking down the aisle of an airplane. You have like one kid under an arm and the other one's screaming and snot coming out of the nose. And if it's a dad with those kids, everyone's like, "Oh, what a great dad." And if it's a mom, people are like, "Oh my God, I hope those kids aren't sitting next to me."
Yeah. I mean, you and I could talk for hours about this because I know. You and I should start a podcast about just what it's like to be people of a certain age, realizing that what we all knew all along was like these little skirmishes about cloth diapers were bullshit.
Yeah. I remember looking at colleges with my own parents, you know, many years ago. It's a fun part of life.
Yeah, and how did you choose Vanderbilt?
Both of my parents are from the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, and I'm the oldest of 19 first cousins and have a lot of heritage in the deep
state. 19 children.
Yeah. So no, I got a lot of cousins and a gigantic family all spread across the South, but I grew up in Connecticut. And so everyone I know went to college in the Northeast for the most part. And there's a lot of great colleges here. I figured I would probably end up here in life, but that it would be nice to live in the South. And it was amazing. Yeah. I majored in math in college. I love math. And I've got my two oldest are girls. And so I'm a big proponent of like girls and math and all of that.
And girls in STEM and.
Yeah. And girls in gaming.
Do you have an office in Manhattan?
No, our company is completely virtual, which I don't love, but it is what it is. Like, it's nice for sure. I take my kids to school and I work my own hours and all that stuff. But having built a company virtually during COVID, it's so much better when we are together. It's so much more valuable. You can't innovate and brainstorm on Zoom all the time.
Are these full-time employees or are they giggers?
That is like one of the number one lessons I've learned as a startup founder. Next time I start a company, I will just hire one person full-time first. There's no job description. It's just founder helper. We started a capital raise last summer. We had a relatively easy time raising literally $2.2 million before this raise. And it was an idea and a huge market, and it makes a lot of sense. We were a really good candidate for a crowdfund because we have an existing community. Women aren't often viewed as investors. Women don't view themselves as investors. Investment in women startups in 2022 was down from 2021. So it's going in the wrong direction.
The first time, I noticed that. I wrote a piece about it recently.
So all of these reasons put us in a good position. And, you know, when we go into a Series A, hopefully at some point in the next, you know, year or two, to have a crowdfund is a compelling story. Our community believes in us.
So when you think about forming the Game Hers, how much of that inspiration came from setting an example for your daughters as far as advocating for change in both a social and a monetary way?
A lot of different things led to the creation of the company. One was the knowledge that building a community for people who are trying to find community and can't can be helpful. And that's something my co-founders and I knew from our time in the parenting world when we had a community for expectant and new parents. Another reason that we founded the company was my extended family had experience in the gaming world. My dad and my brother are part owners of an esports team.
Oh, now we're talking. There we go. Okay.
Yeah. And so the video game industry was just on my radar. But most definitely, I have two daughters who are 11 and 13, and opportunities for them as something that I'm always going to be thinking of innately, and the ability to have the opportunities, especially in a place like video games, because I mentioned earlier, I was a math major in college. I'm a huge proponent of girls and math and STEM and esports and gaming, as especially as they become so integrated into kind of our society as a whole. Like, everybody's video gaming, 100% basically of Gen Alpha plays video games. There's a clear pathway to careers in STEM way beyond just being a professional video game player. I mean, it's game development, game design, and all of the different careers that support making a video game or playing a video game or being in that professional space. So of course I want my daughters to have those opportunities. And I think what's interesting about it too is when we started the company 3 years ago, and our company launched publicly on the same day that the CDC declared COVID a pandemic.
Awesome.
So it turned out to be a great time to launch a company in the video game industry. Also a great time to launch a company galvanizing people to support women. And it was before at home school. And so one thing that happened in COVID is, you know, my second and fourth grader at the time suddenly got computers and were doing Zoom school overnight, probably a little bit earlier than they would have otherwise become so computer literate, but, you know, not too much. The world is going in a direction that it's going. Also, video games provided a lot of connectivity for so many kids during COVID that they wouldn't have otherwise had, my own kids included. And so it's become more and more meaningful that I have two teen daughters.
As their mom, how do you monitor what they do and how often they do it? And what's your opinion of how parents should raise gamers in general, much less girl gamers?
It's a really interesting question. So to take a step back for a minute, what's important for parents to think about is, number one, of course, we still want kids to have actual human interaction. It's also important for kids to play. That's been the case since the beginning of humanity. They're merging in, we are as a culture, merging into a place where the online and the offline worlds for kids are fluid. They have, you know, they'll have a conversation in the chat of a game online, and then they'll see each other, and then they'll pick it up, and then they'll go back to it. So in terms of the answer to the question, how many hours a day or what should, that's really an individual and a family decision. I think what is more important and sort of some tangible takeaways for parents and things that might be a good idea to do. Number one, if kids seem to like to play video games, do you know what games they're playing? Have you played with them? Have you watched them play? That's like 101. If you understand what they're doing, it's going to be a little easier to interact with them. Not that you have to play the game with them, although that would be, you know, wonderful. Number two, I think, is understanding, you know, there's a difference between all sorts of screen time. Sometimes if they're playing with their friends, like during COVID, a lot of people played video games with their friends. That was what they were doing at that time to interact with kids when they couldn't otherwise interact. Do you want your middle schooler to be playing a video game overnight all night with their friends and then be tired for school? Of course not. But I can give you an example with my own family during COVID. Very sadly for us, some of our best friends moved from across the street in New York from us to Philadelphia. And that family had two girls just around the same ages as my two girls. And one thing that they do almost maybe once a week now, they get online, they play Roblox, they chat with each other, they laugh. And they could do that, you know, on a Saturday afternoon for a few hours. So it's both and. You also asked about how is it different for girls? And there are some very broad statistics and analyses that you can see. I mean, it is still the case that in early middle school, kids are gaming together a lot. The boys and the girls are all gaming together. And then for whatever reason, boys tend to play first-person shooter games more. By the way, there are a lot of girls and women who play first-person shooter games as well, a lot.
A lot of female friends who are really into Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, but statistically, yes, more boys do. And so the girls get left out almost just, you know, for the reasons that middle school is awkward. Maybe you love the game, but you don't want to be the one girl. And girls tend to like games that are more about building and creating and communicating and hanging out. My daughters right now love Minecraft. They can't get enough of it. So I think that we can talk about this at length, but the challenges for girls.
Stay tuned for episode 3, 4, and 5 of this same podcast.
Yeah. I mean, the challenges for girls and women and who play video games and who work in the industry and who are trying to address the problem of the lack of equity. The challenge is that there are many challenges, and it's a pipeline problem from middle school up. It's a hiring problem. It's a retention problem. It's a media problem. And then overlaying all of that is the fact that the whole video game industry needs a big PR campaign behind it to recenter how we think of video games as, you know, as a culture.
And speaking of goofing around and building things, you are listening to the successfully funded podcast brought to you by KiwiTech, a growing ecosystem of entrepreneurs, investors, mentors, accelerators, incubators, and corporations. We help early and growth stage startups build viable products, drive traction, raise capital, and scale their businesses. Now, before we get started, a brief disclaimer: KiwiTech is not acting as a broker, dealer, or investment advisor, and is not registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission in any such capacities. At no time does KiwiTech provide investment advice, endorsement, analysis, or recommendations with respect to securities. Information contained herein should be viewed for entertainment purposes only. KiwiTech does not verify or assure that information provided by any issuer offering its securities is accurate or complete, or that the valuation of such securities is appropriate. Investing in securities, particularly in securities issued by startup companies, involves substantial risk, and investors should be able to bear the loss of their entire investment. Now, those are just the greatest hits of our disclaimer, which is available on our website at successfullyfundedpodcast.com/disclaimer. So enough of that. And now to talk about the Gamehers, GAMEHERS, a woman-led community dedicated to advancing the role, voice, image, and power of the 1.4 billion female and female-identifying gamers whom the gaming industry vastly underserves. And I'm here with the co-founder and CEO, Rebecca Dixon. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
So great to chat with you too. I know we've done a lot of chatting so far offline about our mutual backgrounds. And from what I know of you as an entrepreneur, as a community builder, and someone with a deep interest in gaming, this seems like the perfect next step for you after Mommy Bytes was acquired. Let's talk a little bit about Mommy Bytes and how the experience of creating that and exiting that led you to start the Gamehers.
Mommy Bytes is a community for expectant and new parents. And it was created in 2010 and grew pretty quickly to the point where brands and companies who existed in the parenting space, everything from baby bottles to baby carriers, wanted to work with Mommy Bytes and wanted to reach them. My personal background in the corporate world prior to Mommy Bytes was in media buying and advertising sales. So as a member of the Mommy Bytes community, because I had a daughter in 2010, I actually received their newsletter and I was an active member, and they were looking for somebody with sales and sponsorship experience to help them monetize their business. So I joined the team, helped them grow it, and then we were able to sell it. We sold the company in 2016 to a media conglomerate in New York, and it was an incredible experience. So by this point in time, I had 3 kids and was spending a lot of time talking to people, following, you know, what's hot, what's new. And it was hard to open any news source at that time or have conversations with anybody I knew without the video game industry getting on my radar, because it's an astronomically large industry. The quote that a lot of people, the statistic that is often quoted is, if you take the size of the movie industry plus the music industry, add those together, multiply that by two, the video game industry is bigger than that. Everyone plays games. Generation Alpha, which is coming up, you know, 99.9% of Generation Alpha games. And on top of all that, half of gamers in the world are women. My dad and my brother are part of the original investment team behind Optic Gaming, one of the pro esports teams. So while I hadn't been in the industry myself, it was a conversation topic that came up at extended family Thanksgiving dinners quite often. And so I started following it. You know, coming from the baby and parenting industry, where there's such a value in community, like, you know, I just had a baby. What is this? What do I do? And then all the things that come for the next however many years. So your kids goes to college. It's really helpful to have a community and resources and things to read and people to talk to and events to go to. So knowing that, it was like, where's the community for women gamers? Because there are 1.5 billion of them in the world. And that, first of all, is shocking. No one believes that. In fact, often in meetings with potential investors, they don't believe it, but it's true. Yes, some games aren't exactly half and half, but broadly, women are half of gamers. And in looking for the community behind or the community for them, there wasn't one. So, you know, initially with some of the members of the team from Mommy Bites launched the Gamers. We launched on the same day the CDC declared COVID a pandemic with a newsletter and an Instagram account and a podcast. And here we are 3 years later. We've got over 500,000 people in our extended network across a whole variety of platforms. We have an app. We have the Gamers Awards, and have done a lot and look forward to doing a lot more for women in gaming.
And I want to talk a lot about that, the trends you've perceived and how you see them extrapolating going forward. There are a lot of women listening to this. To what extent, again, this is a very broad question, so you can distill it down however you like, but the experience of being a mom and entrepreneur, so what's the most prevalent aspect of it that you think women can relate to, or you should warn women against, or figure out how to deal with once when it happens?
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways that I could answer that. And so I'll just give you a few thoughts. I think that number one, as a parent, I feel value in demonstrating the fact that I'm starting a company. The mission behind our company, I think, is important. The thing I've learned almost more than anything as a founder and somebody who's working at a startup is that my most precious thing in the world, of course, outside of people, is time. And two things in my life that take up the most time are my children and my startup. And so it's a balance, but it's not usually balanced.
There's no such thing. Yeah. Work-life balance doesn't exist. Because the follow-up to that question is, as a woman, you're probably asked that a lot more than the average male entrepreneur, right? And I make a point, every male entrepreneur I talk to, I talk about what's your family life like?
Yeah.
Just because it's a universal thing, and yet women are asked about it a lot more as a social construct. Like, oh, she's a woman. If she has kids, number one, she's the primary caregiver, and therefore we should talk about her family because that's the more salient aspect of her life than, say, a father in that space is.
Yeah, I commend you for asking men that as well. And I think, you know, the most important strategy that I found around it is just figuring out what are my non-negotiables on my calendar each day. And some of them are going to be work related and some of them are going to be family related. And I would think that advice would work well for men or women.
But in general, as a mom, does that come up when you talk to investors? Do you feel that's a disproportionate burden on you to have to talk about your family, or perhaps to explain to people who are investing in you that even though you are a mother, you're still also a capable executive who's done this before she was a mom and is doing it now and in a way that doesn't impact how you run your company?
You know, I think that at the end of the day, what I have found, and certainly for this stage in our life as a company, the people who have invested in us and the future investors are going to invest in us very much because of getting to know me and our team, and then through me, our vision and what we see in the future. Does my family affect that? I mean, it's part of who I am. So it would seem odd to me to really get to know somebody well enough that they were going to invest in our company and for that not to have come up, because it's a part of who I am and it does drive what I do. Now, does that mean that we might have an investor meeting set up sometimes and my kid gets sick and I am the one for whatever reason that day is dealing with it? Yeah, but I mean, that's life. You know, I'm very lucky. I have a husband who I've been married to for almost 18 years. I think that as far as investment goes, at the end of the day, it is about me. And then as time goes on, it's also about the numbers and the data and the product market fit and all the same things that it's about for anybody.
Let's talk about the numbers, because this idea is going to go very far simply on the idea that it's necessary, that it's something that helps people, it advocates for people, connects people. These are all excellent things that are in desperate short supply. But then there's also the more bloodless investor is more like, that's great, but how am I going to make money in this? Right. So when you put together a business plan, saw this enormous market, half the gaming industry, how did you make a case for carving out a slice of that for the Game Hers and in terms of what your long-term plans are?
Well, first of all, we launched as a community to see if women gamers needed a community. And here we are 3 years later and we have 600,000 people in our network.
Wow.
So that speaks for itself, right? The community was needed.
How did that build? How did people hear about you? And how did that, I mean, 600,000 people in 3 years, that's astonishing. How did that build grow so fast?
Well, I mean, I would say number one, because there are a lot of women who game and there wasn't a place for them to go. Number two, my team has experience in building community. It's exactly what we did at Mommy Bites. And so the tactics around building community, there are many. The important thing to always do is look at the community, see what they're talking about, engage with them, survey them, focus group them, meet them, and respond accordingly. One of the first things that put us on the map 4 months into our existence was the Game Hers Awards. There had never been an award show focused on women. And we launched the Gamers Awards honoring 25 people across a number of categories from development to content creation, esports, collegiate. They were on Twitch. They went viral. It was just an astounding success. So that's how we got kind of a brand that people had heard of. And then in terms of, well, okay, we're a community, but are we a business? The ways that we think about making money now and in the future, there's sort of two different main ways. You know, it's free to join our community and you download our app and go on our metaverse platform, watch us on Twitch, join our Discord. We have free events more and more. And we look forward to doing that forever. That being said, there's some real value that we can offer that we are rolling out this year to targeted groups within the community, because of course, to say women in gaming is very broad. And so if you think about some specific groups, like one is parents of young gamers who don't quite understand the value of video gaming in the first place, or their kid is on Discord and they don't know what Discord is, or, you know, what's Web3 and, or, you know, should my young adult or, you know, college kid be creating a personal brand? And is that, what's the value behind that? Or is there value? So a sort of subscription service for parents is something we're rolling out. There's a similar, but, you know, relevant to college students model that we're rolling out. And then a professional focused group. We've been talking a lot about people who play video games, but there's a similar challenge for people who work in the video game space. So if you think about the fact that half of gamers are women, half of game developers are not women. So addressing that in the professional space in terms of networking and finding jobs. The other piece of it, which is really meaningful and something that is still not completely understood in the world of branding, is when you think about the math, half of gamers are women and everybody plays video games all in the next generation. So if you're a brand and you want to meet your consumers, a pretty good place to find them is going to be video games. The sponsorship model and the partnership model, it's not always one that investors, you know, of scaling companies want to see as the only thing. We know that, and that's fine. But the upside potential here is astronomical. Because one of the big questions that we get asked a lot is like, well, what categories should be thinking about advertising or partnering with the gamers? And the answer to that is every category. One of the brands that did get into this space pretty early on, and it shocked people, and then it shocked me that it shocked people, was Tampax. Why wouldn't they? It was brilliant. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You talk about advertising in general, and the consensus seems to be that advertising money is a finite pie. One area improves, another is going to shrink a bit. Is it fair to say then that the money you've raised so far is based upon just the high ceiling, even though you haven't quite achieved that yet? You're just, it's the plans for the ceiling that you're going to get.
Oh, yeah. Riot Games was one of our initial investors. And then a number of angel investors and a couple of, we were in an accelerator program, Stadia Ventures, but we haven't raised a Series A yet. So our raising now was to develop our app. It was from the people who understood our vision early on, which was, you know, as we see it, not hard to understand. The numbers are clear. The market is, you know, the total addressable market is big. We already can show a lot of data around traction on our app. That's a big one. We've got 26,000 people in the app. And it's, you know, continuing to grow. But in terms of the revenue, you know, I think with scalable venture-backed companies and funds, everybody wants to see recurring revenue. And so that's what, you know, that's what we're going to be able to show.
And what are the features of the app that attract people in such numbers?
So the app, right, the app in its version right now is essentially a social network. Women in gaming, or even the gamers, is quite a broad category. You could be
broad.
You know, somebody who works in game development, you know, in a very technical field. You could be someone who just plays video games that ages. It could be anything. So the groups are everything from collegiate esports to, you know, different games to pets and hobbies. And they talk about all different things in the different groups. What makes our app unique? Number one, it is the only app that is focused, you know, that it's a women-centered app. I should say men are allowed on our app. You know, everybody is allowed on our app. We have a very strong LGBTQ community. So the fact that it is inclusive and supportive is what people report liking a lot about it. It also has a self-security measure, which is that if you have an interaction with someone you don't like, you can block them and you won't see them again. That's a big deal, because a lot of people have asked us before, well, what about Discord? So first of all, we have a very robust Discord community that interacts, you know, great and, you know, works really well. And we love Discord. We partner with them. The thing about Discord is it's two things. Number one, you don't usually go on Discord to find someone to game with. Like, Discord is a place you go to an existing community that you know about, and then you join the Discord. So if you're someone, a lot of women, for all the many reasons that this happens, stopped playing video games in middle school, or played but didn't play with people, or, you know, played on their own, or didn't, you know, weren't as public about it. So there are a lot of women who are looking for people to play video games and can't find someone. They were throwing Hail Marys out on Twitter and saying, I'm Rebecca in New York and I want to play, you know, all this. So
yeah, that's not the most efficient net to cast into the ocean.
No. Yeah. So it's convenience factor of finding people to game with. And then the second piece of it is the security. On Discord, if you have an issue with somebody, you can't delete the chat or the, you know, all of the things that led to your issue. Then you have to sort of lodge a complaint, and it's a whole process. Whereas our app, it's just immediate. So it's, people like that it just feels safe and supportive.
It sounds like everyone is their own editor. Everyone edits their own community and can bounce people out if necessary. But as this grows and as you cater to more people, then you're definitely going to have more customer service to deal with, especially when it comes to bad interactions with people. I mean, that's just kind of the nature of the beast at this point, right? Humans are going to get together and people are going to piss each other off.
Yeah.
So as you prepare for that and we start talking about potential headwinds here, what editorial responsibility do you bear now, and how do you see that escalating going forward?
So, I mean, it's a couple of things, and we're a young company in a space where there are a lot of titans. And so certainly what the things that we've seen with the larger social networks we follow. But in this moment, as we know from those titans, there's only so much that can be done, even if they put all the tech in place that they possibly can. For us, it was all supportive and great and lovey-dovey until we hit a threshold. I mean, we had a crazy situation happen all at once. And once it happened, we did some research and it's like, oh yeah, you hit that point where a lot of men who, by the way, we not only allow men on our app, we need men everywhere in all the places where we are to be supportive in women-centered spaces. And obviously, you know that. However, there were some men who weren't supportive and instead were posting pictures of things that women didn't want in the app.
I apologize for my half of the speech.
Yeah, but it was immediate. And at the size where we were, we had humans in place to monitor it and fix it. I think what I'm going to say in terms of what is our editorial responsibility, it's something that we are very aware of. Our app will lose its specialness if it becomes a place that isn't primarily supportive. And what we really believe, and this is from a lot of focus groups and surveys and data, the option to block someone yourself makes people in the app feel like they have the power. We do believe that will continue to be meaningful. And the fact that there are so many women who game and who are wanting community and enjoying the opportunity to have community, there will always be people who are supportive and positive. And the nature of the existence of the app is positive.
What's been the female experience among competitive gaming? And when you think about the next frontier of how gaming is going to blow up, do you see women becoming more welcomed in that as it progresses?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one thing that I'll mention is that when we launched, there was no community for women gamers, and there was not much discussion around women in gaming, other than the statistic that came up at a lot of investor conferences around half of gamers being women. That has changed full stop. I mean, it has changed a lot. And that's great. And it's also great for our business. A lot of times, some companies, which I can share with you specifics, have launched over the past 3 years, and my inbox will be inundated with like, oh my gosh, is this a competitor? The answer is no. There actually still isn't a community for women gamers that I know of that's anywhere near the size that we are. There are many that we partner with, but the fact that organizations in the esports and gaming industry are thinking about women more is phenomenal. A lot of agencies have popped up that are women focused. That's great. We work with agencies in that we may hire women streamers for brand campaigns and things like that. So those actually definitely wouldn't be competitors. They'd be partners. The other kind of category that's popped up is women only teams. The esports industry as a whole is, it used to be called the Wild Wild West. It's changed, it's merged, companies have bought each other, the structure, everybody's figuring out how to money. A lot of the big pro organizations are kind of operating more like media companies, which is fine. And they have teams in certain games, but you'll see, a certain organization come out with the fact that they have an all women's team. So some of the things around women in gaming can be fixed quite quickly and some can't. And so there's a group of gamers that has to age because you age out of the optimal age to be a pro video gamer by age 24.
Really?
Because you're like eye-hand coordination and finger dexterity. So
wow, far gone from that.
Yeah, it's not in your, not going to happen. What that means is that, by the time most people who are pro gamers, we're well on their way there by the time they were 13. So it goes all the way back to the middle schoolers. And then another part of it is just the culture. A lot of games are team games. So often we'll be asked questions like, what can young boys do? And the main thing young boys do is can speak up if they hear, in the chat, they hear something mean to a girl. Also play with girls, have a girl on your team.
And don't be afraid to lose to one either, because there's no shame in that either.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. There is an intimidation factor. The first comment when we went live on Twitch for the first time we were ever on Twitch as the GameHers, the first comment in the Twitch chat was "Get back in the kitchen." So that's the culture that we're coming from. But what I'll say is, I mean, that was 3 years ago, and we've come a long way as a, you know, as a culture. So yes, I think the future is bright. I always say that salaries are becoming a little more transparent. They're not equal at all right now. And so that'll be another piece of it that we look forward to, you know, to really hoping to be a part of that change.
Yeah, I think it's something just when you say that the women's NCAA final blew away the ratings of everything else.
Yeah, that was a great game, by the way.
And so when I think about it, it makes me think too, like, could esports be under the Title IX umbrella eventually?
In colleges, it is.
It already. Is.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a conversation that we've had with a lot of organizations, actually, because it's complicated. I mean, Title IX is overall for a school as a whole. And so basically esports teams on college campuses are still kind of emerging. There are many, 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 and there are also many places that would like to have them. But if you're at a school that doesn't have an esports team and you would like to start one, it's usually started by a student champion, you know, someone who really puts a lot of time into it. And like anything at a university, it costs money. You've got to get a faculty ally to kind of take you through the process and then get the whole team up and going. So, you know, sort of in off the record conversations, what seems to have happened is that a few years ago when esports teams started materializing on college campuses, Title IX regulators just sort of looked the other way. These aren't my words, but what I've sort of heard through the grapevine is if they didn't look the other way, there weren't women at that time who were trying to start esports teams. And so they just would never have gotten started. So they said, you know, no problem. Or I don't know if they said no problem, but a lot of esports teams are on college campuses, not a lot of women on them. But now, especially as we've just celebrated the 50th anniversary of Title IX, everyone's suddenly like remembering Title IX. And it's like, oh no, now we're, you know, depending on when you say the first esports team was at any college campus, like we're a few years later and there are tons of colleges with esports teams and they have a Title IX problem. So it's something that everybody is thinking about. And I don't know how that's going to get sort of righted. What I do know, we've done so much research on college campuses, really at the ground level. And what we know to be true is there are a lot of women on college campuses who play video games. Are there a lot who are good enough to be on the esports team? How could you prove that? But it's, again, it's a pipeline thing. So as schools start thinking about it and talking about it, we'll get there. And we're trying to do what we can to help in that area.
Well, much of the discussion we talk about is the blue sky, is about how this is poised to break in a lot of positive directions.
Yeah.
And that's what investors have put their faith in. And so when you think about the clouds on that blue sky, as the entrepreneur, as the CEO, what sort of things do you think about that, apart from the normal social headwinds and the difficulty that women have in general existing on this earth, which are legion?
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you not necessarily worry about, but are concerned about in terms of what could affect the blue sky predictions in a negative way?
You know, I think the thing for us that's going to be the most important, certainly in the short term and probably in the long term, is going to be to make sure that we're focused on what we're doing right now to get to the next meaningful milestone. And why I say that is, We talked about two really clear and distinct revenue models that we have right now. One is our sort of B2B sponsorship, partnership, advertising model. And the other one is B2C subscription growth. There are at least five others I could rattle off. One, consultants around what should esports teams do on college campuses around Title IX. That's come in front of us a lot. Another is, you know, thought leadership around strategy and execution of DEI in the esports space. That's something we've actually done. And then a third one is job platform to get women jobs. So there are so many things that under the title, the GameHers, we could really lean into and try to grow under the umbrella of our mission. I think the clouds, the potential clouds in the sky could just be all these different things that seem like, oh, that would be amazing if we could do that. And that would be amazing if we could do that. And, you know, to layer into all of that, we get a lot of inbound requests for support in the vast topic around how can we help women in gaming. That is, it's certainly my main challenge right now, is to stay focused and get to the next tangible milestone.
Well, I think one of the great salient aspects of the business so far is the community that you've built.
Yep.
And you're also first to market, which is terrific.
Yeah.
So in this postmodern social media age, apart from having a good product and a great message, what strategies do you think for building community are going to save us in terms of helping us reconnect and kind of rebuild from these last few years of forced isolation?
I think it's important to figure out what the community is right off the bat, or what the topic is. Like, what community are you trying to bring together? And for us, that was women who game. And you need to know your community. Who are they? What video games do they play? How old are they? Everybody overuses the word engagement, and that's fine. But engaging with and talking to the community, it's so important. You can't not do it. Then think about ways to take that to the next level. We've primarily hired from our community, because why wouldn't we? We have a huge community and a lot of qualified people in many different jobs. Finding allies outside the community, but who have sort of adjacent alignments, super important. That's probably one of the biggest ways that we've grown. And then just, you know, repeat. There are some really specific things that we did. I mentioned the GameHers Awards earlier, honoring women in gaming. And then the tactics behind that are that they weren't honored before. And so then when they are nominated, they're incentivized to share their nomination to have people vote for them. So the word gets out to people who didn't know us before.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, people talk a lot about engaging using gamification, and yeah, you are an actual gaming platform. The awards is a great catalyst as far as getting people excited and rewarding good work, encouraging other people to strive to that level. But what I like to ask also of everyone who's been in a business for a while, when you started this 3 years ago and where you are now, what is the biggest surprise about where you thought you might be versus where you are now? And how does that affect the trajectory going forward?
So we started our company right off of selling Mommy Bites, and Mommy Bites was a phenomenal experience to be well positioned to start the GameHers. What I'm most surprised about is Mommy Bites was a successful exit and the experience was amazing. It was, however, a small, bootstrapped and profitable from the start company. So at the GameHers, we launched, and the level of immediate astronomical growth, and then the need to fundraise, and then the fact that we continue to grow and that we're still here and now on a trajectory to grow a lot more, that's what's surprising to me. We realized very quickly, but we did not launch the company in March of 2020 thinking that it was going to be something that we did, you know, multiple capital raises for, and we're talking about, you know, venture-backed level growth, and we, you know, we're just at the tip of the iceberg.
And you're learning as you go, right? I guess this is this is all new territory for you. So you, like many people, are building the plane while you're flying it, which is one of my favorite metaphors because it scares the hell out of me.
Yeah. It's been an exciting journey.
And congratulations for getting as far as you have. And so if people want to learn more about the GameHers and the crowdfund and everything else you prepare, however you write, however you establish your thought leadership, where can people find you and how can they contact you?
I'm Rebecca Dixon. I'm very active on LinkedIn and my DMs are open. The GameHers is very easy. It's the GameHers with an H in it. Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, Twitch, everywhere. We promote everything that we do everywhere. We have a newsletter. You know, I'm just really excited to have had the chance to get to know you and to be here. Thank you for such a great conversation.
I appreciate it. Thank you right back. I knew we'd have a lot in common, and I knew we'd have a lot of touch points to bounce around on. So, and well, of course, I'll link to all this in the show notes as well, so people can click directly to you.
Great.
Because I do think, you know, one of the pressures of being in your chair is that is communication with people who either are part of the community or want to be. And well, Rebecca Dixon, thank you so much for talking with me today. The company again is The Game Hers. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I've been your host, Doug French, and this is the Successfully Funded Podcast. And we'll see you next time with another story about people trying to do good and do well at the same time. Thanks. Bye-bye.